Hello and welcome to Unscripted. I'm Kavit Athley. Our guest joining us in this edition of the program is Daniel McAdams. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Also co-host of the Ron Paul Liberty Report. He has served as foreign affairs advisor to U.S. Congressman Ron Paul from the years 2001 until Dr. Paul's retirement at the end of 2012. From 1993 to 1999, he worked as a journalist based in Budapest, Hungary, including as editorial page editor of the Budapest Sun, and he also served as a special rapporteur with British Helsinki Human Rights Group while based in Europe. And he joins us now for this edition of Unscripted. Daniel McAdams, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on your show. I appreciate it.
It's great having you. I actually want to break the ice and get warmed up with this post that you had about this brilliant film that you said made by an Israeli Jewish filmmaker 26 years ago. The reason why I'm starting out with this is because what stood out in your description there, which you said was an integral part of my awakening on the Israeli issue. Maybe you could tell us in short what this film was all about and why you think it was important in your awakening on the Israeli issue.
Well, the film is, and I actually made a mistake in the initial post. It was, I think, 16 years ago, not 26 years ago. My math wasn't very good at the time I posted it. But it was, the filmmaker's name is Yoav Shamir. He's an Israeli filmmaker. He made that film. He also made Checkpoint and a few other films about the situation primarily in the West Bank, but certainly the situation among Palestinians. And what Defamation was about is the brainwashing of young Israelis from a very early age to the view that if they don't, you know, essentially destroy all of their enemies, another Holocaust will happen. And Yoav Shamir, in his brilliant way of making the film, Professor Finkelstein is in the film as well, but it really highlights how the Anti-Defamation League, the ADL in the United States, conspires to invent and create anti-Semitism where there really isn't any. And there are several scenes in the film where something very, very non-controversial is treated as an act of anti-Semitism. So it was an extremely well-done film, and it really moved me along in the process. Aren't always as they appear. That and Checkpoint, which is a great film that shows the horrible situation for West Bank residents when they want to go to the doctor and when they want to go to the store or anything, how they're treated like inhuman. And let's not forget, this is well over 10 years ago that he made this film. I'm absolutely certain it's much, much worse these days.
Well, let's talk about that a little bit, because I'm sure that then you must be shocked as to what's going on, not only in the Gaza Strip in terms of the genocide there, but also in terms of what's happening in the West Bank, which is, in essence, almost the same thing, but maybe it's in second gear at this point, moving on real fast in terms of displacement, in terms of all the different things that are happening, from human rights violations, etc. Does it surprise you when you see the genocide that has happened in terms of the depth that Israel has to basically carve up the land? We know in the West Bank they're very proud to say we're going to take over 82% and annex it.
Well, what surprises me even more than that, because we've seen a pattern for decades of Israel's behavior, but they'd always had some sort of a check on their bloodthirstiness, and now the check is gone, the reins are off. What really surprised me is to see a world stand by while a genocide is taking place right before their eyes, and many of these people saying never again, rightly so, to the genocide that was launched toward the Jews in Europe in the 1930s and 40s, and we're having the same situation right before our eyes. And unlike in those years, we can actually tune into X or any other network and see in real time the destruction, the maiming of children, the killing of, they say, upwards perhaps even of hundreds of thousands, multiple hundreds of thousands of innocent civilians being killed. And the world stands by and does nothing. And it's primarily because the United States stands by and does nothing and watches this happen. This will be a black stain on the United States and the American people for centuries to come.
Taking a look at now what the Israeli regime is doing, we understand it's continuing the genocide no matter what. And obviously the U.S. has its back when it comes to the military support or the U.N. veto, as we just saw 24 hours ago. But we're also looking at an expansionist Israeli regime, where in West Asia, we call West Asia, the Middle East, people know it as, and how it's going after other countries. And the attack on Qatar, I think, was a game changer in many different ways. We're looking at how the Israeli regime basically broke the regional taboos to hit a major non-NATO U.S. ally between Israel and Hamas. It's really incredible that they wanted to take out the host country that has the mediators there. What was your initial reaction on this? And do you think that that's a game changer? In what ways?
Well, not only that, it's such an act of treachery. And this is a pattern that Israel and the U.S. have done, which is to announce that you're going to have negotiations. And as soon as you gather the negotiators together, the Israelis, with the United States seal of approval, will kill those intermediaries, will kill those negotiators. It happened to Iran. We saw just before the sneak attack of Israel on Iran. It's happened in the past several times. It happened to Soleimani, who was getting ready to board a plane on a peace mission to negotiate peace when he was destroyed by Trump in the first administration. And now we see the same thing happening, attempted same thing happening in Qatar. There have been other instances as well where you actually kill the negotiators who are trying to negotiate peace. That is a clear signal. It should be a clear signal to the rest of the world how Israel views peace negotiations. The way Israel views peace negotiations is how they behaved toward Lebanon and Syria. We do regime change, we decapitate your regime, we disarm you completely, and then the peace that you get is the peace that we impose on you. And so the lesson should be clear for Israel's Arab neighbors. And sadly, it doesn't seem to be getting through, but all you have to do is take a look at the map of Greater Israel, which they are not ashamed to show to anyone. They're not ashamed to hang it up behind them when they're speaking. They want a big chunk, not only of Saudi Arabia, but Iraq, of Turkey. And these countries still, they seem like it's, they don't view it as a serious threat. Well, I think with the one thing that Israel has shown in the last, since 2023 October, is that they're a threat to anyone, and they're not willing to back down. They will conquer every country in the region and subjugate it to Israel's will. So it's disheartening. You even have such a weak response from Qatar. Qatar is a major U.S. ally, the largest U.S. military base in the region. They clearly, unless the U.S. gave a green light, which probably is what happened. But then again, that speaks volumes as well. What a treacherous ally the U.S. is to green light an attack on a partner. So I would just say that the U.S. diplomacy has absolutely been destroyed by its absolute fealty, its absolute subservience to the state of Israel.
Well, I'd like to discuss that a little bit in detail in terms of the U.S. role here, because we know the U.S. President Donald Trump said that he was not aware that this was going to happen. And then he said, yes, we were given a heads up, but it was so late in the game that we didn't have a chance to really relay it in enough time for Qatar to react. But the skies over Doha, as far as we know, are monitored by Al Udeid, the largest U.S. military installation. We know that this is not a marginal outpost. It's the forward headquarters for the U.S. Central Command, U.S. CENTCOM. And in theory, anything entering Qatari airspace or nearby region without being detected by the IAMD, which is Integrated Air and Missile Defense System, that provides air cover for the Persian Gulf Cooperation Council, which has Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Bahrain, and UAE, along with Jordan in it. There's no way that the U.S. would not have been aware of this Israeli intrusion into the Qatari airspace. So Trump's claim falls flat. Given that, are we looking at the fact that now the Persian Gulf Arab countries are definitely rethinking how the U.S. is claiming that it's the guarantor of their security, that that's just not going to happen in terms of how it suits the U.S.'s purpose?
Well, either the U.S. is completely incompetent and its weapons don't work to fulfill its obligations in the region to protect not only its own troops, of course, which is very important, but as you point out, its partners in the region. Either our weapons don't work very well or someone told them to stand down. Now, it may not have been the president. I think that's something that we have to consider, that there may be someone in control of this in his administration that is not him. He's not a detailed person. He doesn't like long briefings. He likes things very simplified. He may have just delegated this to someone, this whole operation to someone, and you know he can claim plausible deniability. Yeah, we knew about it, but it was late. Nobody's buying that. These things don't work that way. You don't just You don't just flip a switch on. They're as you point out, they're integrated. They're automatically integrated to protect our troops and our partners in the region, or they're not. So I would think that obviously they stood down because the U.S. seems to have this idea. I believe it takes its Arab partners for granted, and there is a precedent for it because they have shown a lack of willingness to stand up in the face of continued, continued behavior by the U.S. in the region that shows that they're not viewed as an equal partner. But maybe this may be the issue. This may be something that brings them together. But I don't think we've seen a lot of evidence so far.
Yeah, it was very interesting when that summit happened, when you had Qatar invite, and in attendance were obviously the countries in the Persian Gulf, including not only Bahrain, the UAE, but also Iran attended. And at the end, the final communique was basically words of condemnation. Many were very disappointed in that. But then, lo and behold, you had this Pakistan-Saudi Arabia defense pact, which was, that was quite an eye-opener. I'm wondering why Saudi Arabia chose Pakistan, because when you take a look at the fact that Pakistan is nuclear-armed, and then for the military agreement to happen, Mohammed bin Salman said that promises to boost defense cooperation and joint deterrence. Tell us your reaction to this joint pact, and how much of a possibility is there for other countries to join in?
Well, I think the prince was sending a very clear signal to the U.S., and it's probably the strongest and clearest signal that it can send to the U.S. I wonder about Pakistan's reliability, because the U.S. is always trying to infiltrate the Pakistani government. They've jailed Pakistan's independent-minded leaders in the name of Imran Khan and others. So the question is the reliability. But yes, definitely, there's no question about it. You're right. I mean, the juxtaposition of this conference in the Gulf and this agreement just a few days later sends a clear signal. And I think the signal is that that Saudi Arabia is ready to become a nuclear-armed country very quickly if this stuff keeps happening.
Why don't we take a look at the fact that you have the Iran coming into the picture after this attack by Qatar, and for the countries to basically reach the terms that Iran has been dealing with when it comes to Israel in terms of it attacking Iran, and Iran saying, see, I told you so, the U.S. cannot be a reliable partner. By default, obviously, the U.S. is behind Israeli moves in the region. Do you think we're looking at now a proactive move by countries in the region to align themselves in order to stand up against the U.S. and Israel? Because like you mentioned, Israel is on a war footing. It wants to expand itself, and other countries are in its firing line.
Well, the other thing to consider is that Israel is also in a race against time. Now, if you look at polling in the United States, support for Israel is at the lowest in its history. Megyn Kelly, who's a very famous U.S. journalist talk show host, said just a couple of days ago in a discussion she had with Tucker Carlson that if you look at the United States, literally everybody under 30 hates Israel. And that's a fact. And it's not just those on the left. It's young American conservatives in the 18 to 40 range who are, for the first time in my entire life, polling shows that the majority of them are opposed to our relationship to Israel. So Israel, I think, understands that it's a race against time. U.S. support right now can only be bought by our bought and paid for Congress and our bought and paid for administration. So they may believe that they have to go for broke now because this may be their last chance. Unfortunately, what that means is they have absolutely no compunction about killing every woman, child, baby, pregnant mother, even donkey in sight. They are going for broke on this, which is a bad situation. But they are also in a situation where they have no allies in the world, no allies in the entire world. And the only ally they have, the United States, is only an ally because the government is bought and paid for by AIPAC and other pro-Israel organizations. And don't forget the multi-billionaire Jewish, primarily Jewish, Americans who put Israel before their own country.
You know, I found it very interesting that just a few days back, you had the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, who came out, and it's one of those rare admissions where he said that, we are somewhat isolated. We have to deal with that fact. And he made a referral to how its economy is not doing well. And in particular, he talked about how Israel needs to be self-reliant when it comes to the arms industry. Because, for example, the UAE and some other countries have actually barred Israel from attending some of these arms expos. Now, when you have the Israeli Prime Minister say that, he says it with confidence as if he's, you know, nothing's going to deter Israel from, again, going on this war footing and expanding itself, which is going to involve more wars. Do you think that that's because it knows that the U.S. is actually going to be behind Israel all the way, and that is why the Prime Minister speaks with such confidence on the matter?
Well, that's one of the few times I would agree with Netanyahu. I mean, if that's your goal, go for it. You know, if your goal is to develop your arms industry independently, but that would also mean without the U.S. dollars, without U.S. technology, without U.S. support. If that's your goal, then I'm all for it, Bibi. Go for it. You know, but I don't think that's the case. I think it's, it wants the gravy train to continue. And don't forget, it's not just American tax dollars that are going for the Israeli military, but a lot of American tax dollars go into it's like a laundromat, a money laundering scheme, where they go into PR firms and think tanks in the Beltway that continue to push our relationships. So the American, poor American worker who's suffering with terrible inflation and a terrible economy is being robbed to pay to be propagandized in favor of being robbed to pay to being propagandized. It's a vicious circle, and the loser is always the American people and, of course, the people on the other end of Israeli bullets and bombs.
All right, let's move on to another topic, and that is one of the countries we mentioned somewhat, which is Iran. What has happened in the past day is the UN Security Council failing to adopt that draft resolution that basically enabled the snapback to officially now be activated. Now, you have basically, to put things into perspective for us, which I'd like for you to do, but I'm looking at the context of Iran trusting the U.S., trusting its European allies. You're looking at, five rounds of discussions that Iran had with the U.S., of which it then got bombed just a couple days later when they were supposed to have a meeting. And then you have the Europeans, where Iran talked with, made an agreement with the IAEA in Cairo, and yet you have, again, this snapback to come back into play. What reasons does Iran have, then, to actually continue this diplomacy that it's still open to do? But, you know, it keeps getting chipped away in terms of its confidence on having diplomacy with the Western nations.
Well, I'm not an expert on public opinion within Iran, but I would guess, if I could speculate, that the Iranian people are probably starting to get frustrated as well, maybe even with their leaders, that we keep trying to play by the rules and we keep getting kicked in the teeth. You know, at what point are we going to say enough? And I'm sure it's a pretty big discussion in Iran among the people. And I saw some things in parliament where there was some anger and frustration about being willing to deal with the IAEA again after what many or most of us consider the treachery of revealing sensitive information that may have led to the murder of a lot of Iranian scientists. So, yes, they played by the rules. My good friend Larry Johnson, who is a CIA officer and a great writer, he points out that he believes the Cairo agreement was a pretty clever idea on the part of Iran to appeal to its very legalistically minded friends in Russia and China and elsewhere. I believe also Pakistan and Algeria have also said that they will not follow along with the snapback sanctions. And I think that the Cairo agreement helped facilitate that, because Russia and China especially can point to it and say, look, they are doing everything they can to avoid this. They're doing everything they can. They're going to even let the inspectors back in, the people who they suspect of betraying them. They're willing to go this far, and still they get nothing for it. So that having been said, with the snapbacks going back into effect, at least from what I understand, maybe there's some new information, but that Iran has said that, well, the Cairo agreement is off then. If you're not going to consider this, then forget it. And if that is the case, it's probably a smart move the way they did it.
Well, that is something that's being discussed. They have not actually declared that to be null and void. They're looking also at another option, which they have discussed, but they haven't gone through yet, the official government line. And that is still being a member of the NPT. But do you think that these moves that are being initiated and now executed by the Europeans in terms of the snapback and by the U.S., whom doesn't seem to be interested in having any form of diplomatic talks at this point, is because that is what their intentions are for Iran to want not to allow IAEA inspectors in the country, withdraw from the NPT to give them a reason, therefore, that, see, this is, as they would like to call it, a rogue nation. We need to attack it.
Yeah, I think that's a big part of it. But, you know, the other issue is unrelated to Iran. Excuse me. Pardon me. And that is European frustration with Russia and China, particularly with regard to the Ukraine war. So in some ways, you know, Iran is in the middle because the Europeans want to punish the Russians, certainly the Chinese, for continuing to do business with Iran, for ignoring the snapbacks, and Russia as well. So in a way, it's Iran getting the short end of the stick, even though they agreed to some of these points with the Cairo agreement. The Europeans have nothing left. They've destroyed their economy. They've destroyed their credibility. They're chasing shadows around, thinking that they're going to destroy Russia and overthrow Russia and invade Russia. So they're grasping at straws. They're desperate. And so I think that's one of the reasons that Iran is kind of a victim here, being caught in the middle of this European war against Russia.
I'm curious about the support of the U.S. I know we're back to that, even though we just covered that. You know, you had the words of Donald Trump that headlined in many periodicals online that said, Benjamin Netanyahu is me. Obviously, I'm not going to use the word. Okay, at the same time, we're seeing how Benjamin Netanyahu is being enabled by the U.S. It almost makes it sound like Trump saying that there's nothing I can do about that, but he realizes what the Israeli regime is doing. I mean, you know, Israeli regime, again, it's aside from the countries that it's targeting, it's also targeting the resistance groups in the region. And we're headed for some times here, like Lebanon, where God knows what's going to happen if this disarmament of Hezbollah is going to be, which is not going to go away, from the U.S.'s sites, including Israel. What do you think about Trump, first of all? Is he in the middle of not being able to do anything, even though he realizes that Israel is, through Netanyahu, doing whatever it wants?
I just don't buy it, you know, because we've seen this before. We've seen Trump express his frustration with Netanyahu before, and I think it's just for domestic consumption. I'm very upset with Netanyahu, and then he holds out the chair for him, right? It was like a couple of days later. This is PR stuff. If Trump were really felt that Netanyahu was giving him the what for, let's put it that way, then there are many moves that he could make. It's just like with everything else with Trump. It's just hollow air. It's hollow wind. There's no substance to anything that he says. So, I mean, I think the only interest Trump has in the whole region is the idea of developing the Gaza Strip into some sort of a big Trumpian paradise, for his son-in-law to make more billions off of. And I say this as someone who wanted Trump to win. I do not have Trump derangement syndrome. I was happy that Trump won. I don't vote, so I didn't vote for him, but I was happy that he won. So I'd simply judge him on his actions as president. And between this and blowing up a bunch of ships, a bunch of little boats outside of Venezuela, and in a constant bombing of Somalia and other places, the idea that he's the peace president is getting a little bit worn thin.
Well, he recently came out and made another revelation, of which he did talk about prior when he ran for presidency, back in the year, I believe, 2020, and that's about trying to get back Bagram Air Base. I mean, let's spare thought here for Trump, who is supposed to be a peace president based on the platform he ran on. But as you said, he's bombing countries. He's launched deadly military strikes, civilian boats that you mentioned, preemptive military strikes on Iran. You have the bombing campaign in Yemen. Let's see, what else have we got? Desire to annex Canada, Greenland, Panama Canal, the Gaza Strip, and now directing Pentagon to target these drug cartels in Mexico as well. And now focusing on Afghanistan. I mean, did he put on a show, do you think, so he can pursue his goals now that he's reached power?
And don't forget his war on the American people, the war on the First Amendment here at home. If you happen to say something critical of Israel, you know, you're going to get nabbed. If you happen to be a foreign permanent resident, you're going to be sent back to where you came from. You know, so there's war on every single front, even as he comically says that he's solved seven wars, and it would have been eight if he only would have been able to solve the Russia war, but he's still working on it. It's sort of a it really is, you know, he's famous for being a reality TV star. This really is the reality TV show president, where every week there's a new chapter, there's a new episode that comes out with some new comical scheme that we can all laugh at and think, aha, that's crazy, that's funny. It just feels that way. It feels like we're all being gaslit by this administration. And I've never seen, in my memory goes back to the Nixon administration even, I've never seen an administration this chock full of incompetence, of people who don't understand the basics of the American Constitution, for example. His attorney general saying that we don't have any right for hate speech and it'll be prosecuted, we're going to hunt you down. She doesn't understand the Constitution. It really is a government of the most incompetent people I've ever seen in my life.
Well, maybe there's a silver lining to all of this in terms of what's happening with other countries, in particular in the East. I don't know if you caught some of the scenes coming out of the SCO that was held in Tianjin in China. And basically, many headlines read global wealth and power are pivoting to the East, China building its relationship with India in terms of the BRICS countries, surpassing the G7 in terms of their economic output. I don't know if you saw the scenes of almost a huddle between the Chinese president, the Indian president, and the Russian president. Of course, Iran is part of the SCO as well as a member. Are we really looking at this pivot to mark a new global order that surpasses the previous global order, but for it now to be perhaps more active in standing up to the U.S.?
It's amazing to see what's become of the SCO. I actually visited the headquarters in Shanghai back, I think, in 2006 when it was just getting started. And I was working for Dr. Paul at the time. We both had an inkling that this might turn out to be something significant, a different move for the rest of the world. And it obviously, this latest conference has shown, as you very well point out, has shown a serious, serious level of coordination and organization. The real tragedy here is that the U.S. should want to be part of this. These are countries that are investing in development in technologies that we don't even have in the U.S. We spend at least $1.5 trillion a year on our military, on protecting our overseas empire, while Americans are struggling to survive in an economy that's terrible with inflation out of control. We should want to be part of this. That's the ethos of America, doing business overseas, trading. It could be enormously profitable for the United States. But unfortunately, we're governed by a bunch of knuckleheads who only know how to enrich the military-industrial complex to the detriment of every one of the rest of us.
All right, and my final question to you, since we have run out of time, unfortunately, I had so much more to cover with you, is the fact that we are still looking at many who are interpreting this ceasefire between Israel and Iran to be temporary, that Israel is going to attack Iran again. Israel just boasted about their laser beam, defense shield that acts like a defense shield for any incoming missiles. Iran just tested its own Khorramshahr, which is said to be able to penetrate, obviously, the Israeli airspace and hit its target with pinpoint accuracy. It did so on many occasions in the 12-day war. If there was a war to be ignited, what type of outcome? I know this is just speculation, but what type of outcome do you foresee happening here?
Well, first of all, no one wants it to happen. Certainly I don't, and you don't. No one in Iran wants it to happen. Most people in the United States do not want it to happen. But I don't think the Israelis can – they don't have an off switch right now. They are fired up, and they're ready to destroy all of the people they consider to be their enemies. So I think there's a very, very high chance of Israel doing it again. And they're going to want to – and I hope I'm wrong. For God's sake, I hope I'm wrong. They're going to want to do it as they see support for Israel flagging in the United States, as I said earlier. They're going to want to do it sooner rather than later. I hope it doesn't happen, but certainly, I mean, if I were in charge of Iran, I would never let my guard down. And I think even the head of the Mossad said the other day, we have even more treachery planned, even more secret nasty things that we have planned for Iran. And we saw what they did last time by infiltrating their agents into Iran and killing a lot of very, very important key people. So unfortunately, I don't think they have an off switch. They're not going to not do it. And hopefully, and I think there's a lot of people cheering Iran on, believing that that Israel needs to have a real black eye so they, you know, basically sober up and stop acting like the bully in the neighborhood.
All right, Daniel McAdams, thank you so much for this interview. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Well, you just heard Daniel McAdams, executive director of the Ron Paul Institute. We ended it on the fact that he does believe that there will be another attack by Israel on the Islamic Republic. Of course, way that the Iranian military has been testing some of the different missiles like the Khorramshahr that I stated shows that it'll be up for a bruising. For Mikhail Tafoy and the entire team here at Unscripted, that's goodbye.
In the night, there's a lesson in every action. Our intentions always right. Oh Allahu Samad, the self-sufficient one, far from limitation. You are the mighty one. Today is a celebration. Time. We go to the mosque and pray together, standing side by side. We celebrate from morning to night. May your Eid be warm and bright. Time to reflect and evaluate and thank Allah for this life. Today is a celebration.
Designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the Redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and a very warm welcome. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I'm your host, Zainab. And we have our special guest, Dr. Ali Alavi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, sir.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Alavi is a scholar in the Hawza Ilmi Aqom and has expertise in the field of Mahdawiyyah. In this program, we try to gain more and more knowledge about the Imam of our time and the events that will be following him or before him, so that we get the maximum knowledge of our Imam. Because as we have the hadith from Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified family, that a person who dies and dies without recognizing his Imam dies the death of an ignorant. So, inshallah, we won't be among them, and this program is going to help you increase more and more knowledge about the Imam of time. So, Dr. Alavi, today we want to discuss a very important topic with you. Like everyone is waiting eagerly for the advent of Imam, and we have some of the narrations wherein we are given some symptoms, what kind of changes will take place when Imam will come back. So we want to analyze them, what kind of individual changes, societal or economic or also in the environment, what kind of changes will take place. So let's begin with the individual changes.
The world before the advent of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and right at the threshold of the emergence of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, is actually has been described by the infallible Imams earlier, I mean centuries back. And the world that is going to accept Imam as the Imam of the world and Imam of the whole universe has some signs. I mean, there are some transformations in the world at that time, in that emergence threshold. So these changes, or let's call them transformations, are good to be understood and analyzed from different perspectives. One from the personal and individual perspective, and second from the transformations that we can find in the societal level, then economic one, cultural ones, political transformations. And at the end, we shall have a look at the transformations with regard to what happens to the nature.
All right.
So these are the things that we shall, inshallah, discuss. But it's important to know that the emergence of the promised Mahdi, or the promised Imam, is the awakening of the final light of guidance and the divine reserve of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. What we call it based on the Quranic teachings, Baqiyatullah. So the purpose is to finish the unfinished mission of the earlier prophets and messengers of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So he comes based on most narrations that is, they speak of the time and era of illumination. I mean, the time of guidance that describes the life and the world before the advent of Imam alayhi salam, with those transformations and what happens to humanity, what happens to man and mankind, that later on when Imam actually appears and Imam comes and his government of justice is going to be widespread in the whole world, people will say lots of bad things about what was in the past. That limited past time, that I mean that the time before the advent of Imam was the time of oppression, the time of wretchedness, the time of wicked people governing all the nations and all the people.
All right, so the first thing that people are going to realize is that the time they had been living in the past was really an oppressive time, and they start realizing the change. Well, how and what are more individual changes? We will talk about that after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go anywhere. Stay tuned.
مهدينا في الأزمان شعظيه ربنا في العالمين أفضع له نور أليق والظالم ما ابتده من أجل السالكين أهدى سنه.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the last savior, and Dr. Ali Alavi is with us. In the studio, we are discussing the individual changes that are going to take place when Imam is going to come back. So, yes. Dr.
So, mankind as the crowning product of universe is going to actually be expecting Imam alayhi salam, but prior to that, there are some transformations that are happening in two categories. One, from the mankind side, the other side, which would be the changes and transformations that we witness and we evidence in the nature.
Yeah.
So we start with, transformations from from an individual perspective.
Yeah.
So what happens? What is the era? What is the time? What is the period like right before the advent of Imam alayhi salam? That is, in the threshold of the advent and emergence of Imam alayhi salam, there are some transformations in the life of human beings and the individuals. So what is it going to be like? We want to say that, the picture that has been depicted by infallibles and infallible Imams, alayhi wasalam, earlier, it says that, there are some issues that goes to men and women separately, though to some extent they are actually, we can call them human beings in general, but, the narrations actually address and differentiate between the roles of these two genders. So we want to say what happens to men and what happens to women and what is their situation going to be like, that actually this picture could be more, clear and vivid for us to know, in case we are expecting Imam Ali Islam, to know that if such a thing happens, it means that the signs of the advent of Imam Ali Islam are very close.
Mm-hmm.
So in Hadith we have that, you see the men while a day is passing on them and they are not without any major sin. A day passes on a man and in that day at least a person actually commits a major sin. These sins have been actually named as fraud, lewdness, and many forms of major sins like that of swindling and all consuming intoxications. So these are the signs for a man in this society. So a person of committing major sins, such as lewdness and fraud and swindling, or even consuming intoxications. But how about the women? As the half of the humanity, or the next half of the humanity, or mankind, are they going
women?
To be, when we are talking about people in that time, are we going to differentiate between them? Definitely. When we're talking about the
different genders,
spread of injustice, spread of oppression, it goes to all. But sometimes some of these things are exclusively for men, or some are exclusively for women. So let's see what the Hadith says as for the status of women.
Well,
this
let's keep that on a pause and increase the curiosity among the listeners. We'll take a short break and we'll be back in a little. Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. We are talking about the interesting topic of the individual changes that are going to take place after the advent of Imam. Well, you said that men, you won't come across men who have not committed major sins and different kind of major sins, including like the intake of intoxications. However, you said for women we have different riwayah. So, yes, we would like to know.
Yeah, and the status of women at that time, when we are saying at that time, the time that we mean is exactly on the threshold of the emergence and advent of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. So, as for the women, the Hadith says that at the end of the time, as the resurrection approaches during the worst of eras, women will appear who are virtually naked and immodest. They will flaunt their adornments, immerse themselves in temptations, and incline toward their base desires and lusts. They will rush after pleasures, treat what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has forbidden as lawful, and they will abide eternally in hellfire. So this is, the way that the women have been described. And to some extent, we can even sense, what has been said, in these days and months and years that we are in.
World,
so to some extent they are being, sensed and can be understood. If, for example, a person was reading or reciting such a narration, let's say, 100 years before, mm-hmm. he might not.
They won't be able to imagine what it's talking about.
Why I'm saying 100 years ago, because I've seen a photo from one of the Western countries for a public walk. Mm-hmm. In which I saw that even the women were covered. Not fully, but at least the ones who we call them. With semi hijab, semi covered. So, but it is totally different with what we today see in our societies and in the world today.
Yeah, so it's quite relatable today, but maybe 100 years ago, this was not relatable.
Very true. So, all in all, when men and women are included in one basket, and they are addressed, and the status of men and women is described in this way. The hadith says that then when men imitate women and women imitate men, so it means that they imitate each other. Wearing clothes and whatever is known to be as a personal, let's say, feature of man.
Yeah.
So women are imitating those features from men.
Indeed.
And men are imitating them from women. And men are satisfied with men and women with women. And when we see, these movements that have been unfortunately
being promoted
dominant in the world the LGBT movements and so on and so forth.
Right.
So, it's not something, except that it couldn't be something except that this.
Mm-hmm.
And women, and when women ride on saddles and false testimonies are accepted, when a person is asked to actually give a testimony,
mm-hmm.
and even he is giving a false testimony, that false testimony is accepted.
Mm-hmm.
While the testimonies of the righteous are rejected.
Right.
This is what the hadith says exactly. And when people take lightly the shedding of blood, look
mm-hmm.
what kind of bloods are shed in the world today, and people take it very light. They take no action. And they stay silent and take no action, and they look to be just indifferent in whatever is going on.
Yeah.
The commission of adultery and usury, the usury, you see that the rights of some are being
mm-hmm.
violated, while others are silent. And unfortunately, even from the Islamic nations, we see even some leaders in Islamic Ummah, they not only actually are not indifferent, sometimes they take the right of the oppressor side rather than the oppressed one.
Right.
So when whom is it vague to know that, for example, America is supporting Israel in the genocide that is happening in Gaza?
Mm-hmm.
But you see, the Islamic leaders, sometimes they compete in visiting with the leaders of
America
and United States.
Yeah.
So how do we want to justify this sort of visits and meetings?
So not only are they indifferent towards the genocide, rather they are, as you said, competing to meet the American administration leaders. That was all the time we had for today's episode. Thank you so much for being with us. So we analyzed the individual perspective. We said for men and women, you won't come across men who have not committed any kind of major sin. And about women, it was like they will be immodest and immersed in temptations, unfortunately. And the bloodshed around the world will be taken lightly and people will be indifferent towards it. And we also said that these things are quite relatable in today's world. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala awaken us and maybe be not indifferent to such kind of crimes and genocide. That was all the time we had for today. Thank you for tuning in. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another episode, take good care. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio.
Good evening to all of our listeners. This is Iran Radio from Tehran. Very nice to have you with us. I'm your host for the next hour. Here are some interesting facts about the Holy Quran I invite you to listen to. Surah Yasin is considered the heart of the Quran for its tremendous benefits for the believer. The best drink according to Quran is milk. In the Quran, Allah also describes the rivers of milk in the heaven. The best food according to Quran is honey, which cures several problems and is the sweetest gift to humans from Allah. Normally, the Quran declares Friday as the most blessed day of the week. The month of Ramadan is the best month of the year, and the night of Qadr has been described as a night better than 1,000 months. Its significance is described in Surah Al-Qadr. We'll start this hour's programs with our evening news bulletin that will be followed by today's special, a special daily mixed format program that deals with various Islamic and Iranian occasions. Our varied radio productions feature comes next. And to round up this hour's programs, we have Leader's Speech. The program presents an English translation of a selection of the statements and speeches of the Honorable Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. Stay with us for the next hour.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: Venezuela has strongly condemned the U.S. seizure of an oil tanker off the country's coast to the Caribbean, calling the move an act of international piracy. The U.S. House of Representatives has advanced the military spending for the next fiscal year that includes hundreds of millions of dollars for Israel. Also in our headlines, renewed clashes between Thailand and Cambodia have entered the fourth day as the two sides continue to trade fire along the border. Hello and welcome, everybody. Here in Iranian capital Tehran, this is World News. Our top story: Venezuela has strongly condemned the U.S. seizure of an oil tanker off the country's coast in the Caribbean, calling the move an act of international piracy.
The Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela denounces and repudiates energetically what constitutes a blatant theft and an act of international piracy, announced